There's a woman that you don't know. She was in the Alaska congregation where I was at for years. And in reference to the prodigal son story, I remember her distinctly coming up to me afterwards. I had done a lesson on the prodigal son. And she just could not grasp the concept of how a father, especially this father in this account, could have forgiven his son for all the damage that he did and all the errors of his ways. It just seemed so unreal, so untrue, and just impossible for such forgiveness to be given. And I will say that those with difficulty in forgiving others usually have difficulty with Christianity at all. And yet the two things are inseparable: forgiving others and being forgiven. Forgiving others and understanding forgiveness. These things cannot be separated. Those who struggle with forgiving others usually struggle with God's forgiveness of themselves. I'm not asking you to learn how to forgive yourself. The Bible never teaches that. But the Bible does teach that we are to understand and accept, to receive the forgiveness that God has for us when indeed it is given. There's a man named Thomas Fuller who once said, "He who cannot forgive others breaks the bridge over which he himself must pass." And the only word I would change there is not cannot, but will not. Because forgiveness is not a cannot thing. It's always a will not thing. It's always something that we choose either to do or not to do. It's not that we're unable. It's that, if anything, we are unwilling to be forgiving. And let me just say on the onset of this lesson, I'm not here to accuse or to say that we've got a bunch of unforgiving people here, and I know who you are, and this lesson is a thinly veiled, you know, barb at you. That's not what this is going to whatsoever. But just to talk frankly and candidly about a subject that I do know, because we're all human, we struggle with this. Some of you have, you know, maybe gotten a lot further ahead than the rest of us, but I do know that we struggle with forgiveness. And those who don't learn how to forgive destroy themselves. And so do those who fail to seek forgiveness. And these are unnecessary choices that are being made. It's always about choices. And yet God always leads by example. He's not obligated to forgive us just because he's God and we're his creation, but he chooses to forgive us. He wants to forgive us. And he's done everything possible for that forgiveness to be offered to us. That's what the Lord's Supper is all about, as Bob had talked about there. We should be looking, you know, forward and backward and upward and inward and understanding all the different aspects of what God has done for us. God forgives us because he's always desired us to live with him. One of the great themes of the Bible, if not the theme of the Bible, is that God wants to be our people and he wants us to be his people, let me say it correctly, and he wants him to be our God. Despite our selfishness, despite our foolishness, despite our bad decisions, our poor judgment, and yet he demands, and rightly demands, that we be forgiven, or forgiving rather, if we are going to be forgiven. We can't be with God if we refuse to be like God. We can't be with God if we refuse to embrace and internalize the very virtues that we desire for ourselves. Forgiveness is hard, but so are taxes, and so is, you know, marriage, and so is child raising, and so is burying your parents. These are all hard things that we have to face in our lives, but we learn how to do them because they're important and they need to get done. Forgiveness is more important than all those things that I just mentioned. Far more important, and we need to learn how to do it if we haven't already and just get it done. It is part of our Christian obligation. It is something that is absolutely required for our salvation. The prodigal son is a perfect story of love without limits and God acting in our best interest in the extension of grace and forgiveness to someone who really doesn't deserve it, because no one deserves grace or forgiveness. But with regard to the older son, it's also a heartbreaking story of failure among those who demand justice rather than showing mercy and compassion. So you see the great success on one side and the great failure on the other. Let me just start out by saying the world is filled with the absence of forgiveness, which is one reason why we struggle with it so much, because it's not natural to us. What is natural to us is hate and resentment and bitterness and paybacks and vengeance. That comes natural to us. Every one of you probably have experienced this. If someone has ever hit you, you want to hit them back. If someone has done you wrong, you want to show them spite and retaliation. If someone cuts you off on the highway, you want to do something to show them how angry you are and how they should never have done that. This is natural to us. This comes almost instinctively to us. And just because we're Christians doesn't mean it ceases to happen or ceases to be something that we're faced with. Actually, we're more aware of it than ever in that case. There are more and more stories with frightening regularity of some disgruntled employee, some jilted lover, some despondent student going postal upon other people. In fact, that word postal comes literally from 1980s events where post office workers took out guns and started shooting their fellow employees. I mean, so when we use it almost jokingly today, like, oh, so-and-so is going postal, but it has reference to actual murders committed because someone wanted vengeance, wanted retaliation, and went about it in a bloodthirsty way. Many shootings are a violent retaliation for being rejected or humiliated or bullied or condemned. It is like the ultimate vengeance. Behind every terrorist attack is some form of hatred or some manifestation of vengeance, regardless of the country or people involved. Litigation is in the United States at an all-time high. There are people suing and counter-suing for every conceivable grievance, even inconceivable grievances. The world is filled with pointless, useless, endless acts of retaliation and retribution. We have smoldering conflicts. We see civil wars going on for years and decades, deep-seated hatred, long-standing vendettas, so-called holy wars. The world is not seeking forgiveness. The world is seeking vengeance. And this is what the world teaches us from an early age. The world teaches us that if someone does something to you, then you have the right to do something to them. So in a world without God, or in a world perhaps with a false understanding of God, vengeance seems right. It seems just. It seems noble. But in reality, it is just an ugly display of human selfishness. That's what God reveals to us. Grudges and vengeance never solved anything or satisfies anyone. All it does is it deepens the wound, it intensifies the pain, and it prolongs the conflict. It doesn't resolve anything. Some people might say after they have shot someone that they were mad at or killed them in some way that I feel better, you know, I feel like I've done what I could do, but the reality is now they are suffering more than ever. And now they're guilty of a sin that, you know, and taking a life that cannot be replaced, and a difficulty that just has gotten so far worse than what they were facing before. God himself never supports selfishness, never endorses human pride. Some people think the Old Testament actually teaches that, as you see on the screen. The Leviticus chapter 24, verse 17 through 20 is a so-called eye for an eye ordinance. God starts out talking through Moses, if a man takes the life of a human being, he shall surely be put to death. And it goes on, whatever he does to injure his neighbor, verse 19, so it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he has injured a man, so it shall be inflicted on him. So this idea is embedded in the law of Moses of a seeming retribution. And some people think that that's what that is all about. Really, an eye for an eye is not about personal vengeance, though. It's quite the opposite. It's really all about law and order. It was necessary to have such an injunction to regulate the behavior of the people. The crime against a fellow person has to be punished. It is not a personal retaliation, but rather to teach that there is a consequence or a penalty for every wrongdoing, for every sinful act. Justice is required in order to keep law and order and to keep society civil. Some have said, and you've heard in years past, you don't hear it too much anymore, an armed society is a polite society. And the idea being there, not to advocate or not advocate guns, but the fact is, if everyone is armed, we're all going to treat each other very respectfully because we know that there will be a consequence or a punishment against us if we don't. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying that that idea is out there. So, and if there is no consequence to breaking laws, including those of governing human behavior, well, there's no use in having laws. And we're seeing that right now in our country. We've got a bunch of laws that are getting broken daily, all the time, and there's no punishment, there's no consequence, and so the law itself loses its teeth, loses all ability to be a law. And it's not helping us, rather we are suffering from that. The second reason for the eye for an eye thing is to regulate or limit the punishment itself. A person cannot inflict more than was inflicted so as to preserve the family, the inheritance, the tribe, etc. And so to save man from himself. In other words, save the society from not overdoing it. So if someone breaks my arm, I don't take my gun out and shoot him, right? I mean, so now I'm retaliating beyond the affliction or beyond the infliction itself. So that's what the law was for. Notice it's never a personal matter. If you read through the text there, you'll find out that the decisions are made and carried out by the community in order to preserve the community. This is not a personal matter. Then someone goes to the law of the avenger of blood in Numbers 35. The whole concept there is that if someone kills another man, then a relative of the one killed has the legal right, God says. This is from God. To go and put that man to death as a means of justice. Not personal vengeance, but the need for justice. And the reason is what you already saw in Leviticus 25:17. If a man takes the life of any human being, he shall surely be put to death. This goes back actually as far as Genesis 9 verse 6. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. When a person selfishly, murderously takes the life of another human being, he is taking an image of God into his own hands and destroying it. And he has no right or authority to do that. And so there has to be a just retribution for that, a legal compensation for that. Life is sacred, it is holy, it belongs to God, and God uses in the law the family member of the one killed as an agent of divine punishment. God also provides grace and mercy. If someone kills someone accidentally, in other words, unintentional manslaughter, then he can go to one of the six cities of refuge in Israel and stay there, have his case heard by the judges of that city, and stay there until the death of the high priest, and he will be protected from the avenger of blood. So God is fair. He is fair in carrying out the justice necessary for the one killed intentionally. He is fair in protecting the one who didn't mean to kill, but did kill someone, and fair in providing recourse for him. Again, all of this is not personal vendettas or personal vengeance. That's why I'm explaining all this, but rather so that we can understand that God had a provision here, and that provision was necessary. What we see here is that God is not sinking to our human base or sensual desires, but is teaching us to see things from, shall we say, his point of view. In Matthew chapter 5, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount, if you wanted to go there, this is the passage that Randy could have read, but again, I knew Randy was up for reading longer. But in Matthew chapter 5, verse 38, you've heard it said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. He's quoting right out of the law. Jesus is quoting here. He says, but I say to you, do not resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If someone wants to sue you and take your shirt, give them your coat also. If someone asks you to go 1 mile, go 2. So what Jesus is not doing is making the law of Moses null and void. He's not saying, I know Moses said that, but never mind what Moses said. He's not saying that. He's saying Moses said those things to preserve society because we need law and order in society. But I'm talking to you personally, that you don't have to have these things done if you are willing to absorb the loss yourself of what needed to be done. And so he's teaching a higher lesson, the higher lesson of non-retaliation. To preserve society, justice is necessary. But for the individual person, he can defer to God and find mercy and a solution, if you will, or resolution there. And of course, we should think about James 2:13. Judgment will be merciless to one who has shown no mercy. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Again, he's speaking to the individual believer and saying that you have a choice to make. You can be merciful or you can be judgmental. You can be merciful and absorb the loss yourself, or you can be judgmental and seek justice. But keep in mind, that is a two-edged sword, and it will come back upon you. The world teaches us to be spiteful, to withhold forgiveness, and to have murder in our hearts. God teaches us to be just the opposite kind of people. Why do we struggle with this? Because the world often has a greater influence on us than God does at times. And I don't like saying that because that's not the way it should be among Christians. But the fact is, you spend a whole lot more time in the world than you do in front of your Bible or with fellow Christians during the week. And that's going to take its toll. It's going to have an effect on you and me. Sometimes our desire for justice and vengeance is not because of what was done to us personally, but because of some perceived injustice towards someone else that we care about. Many crimes are really retaliation, not for what was inflicted upon us, but was inflicted upon friends or family. Kind of what I call the mafia mentality. You going to mess with us? Right? You're going to deal with us. You deal with one of our people, we're going to come after you. Cousin Guido, etc., etc., right? I can't do that very well, but still, you get the point. So, you hurt one of ours, you get hurt. You hurt one of our people, or one of my people, or one of my family, I'm going to take it out on you. And I have experienced this personally. Not that I've gone out hurting people and then had the mafia after me, but the point is, if a family in a congregation, any congregation, perceives that the one of their family members is being dealt with not fairly by, say, the church leadership, now you're not just dealing with that person, you're dealing with the family, because the family wades in and wants to basically defend that person, even when they don't have a case. Right? And so we see the same kind of mentality with the prodigal son. By the way, prodigal is not a word in the story, in the account, Luke 15. Prodigal is a word that we use, but it is appropriate. Prodigal means wasteful or reckless or careless or irresponsible. It also implies arrogance and insolence all wrapped up in one. Because in order to be careless and reckless and so on, you have to be pretty arrogant against the powers that be or against some authority figure. And so we see this prodigal son, as we'll call him, who wasted his hard-earned inheritance money. He didn't earn the money, his father did, but he wasted it. He darkens his father's name and his reputation. He humiliates his father and his father's family. He is a disgrace, not only to himself, but a disgrace to his father. And that makes us angry. That has to affect you somehow. You can't just sit by and read that account and go, huh, yeah, okay, I could see that. He hurt his father. And, and it just doesn't touch you at all. It touches us hard, and we can make it even more personal and say, what if we knew such a person personally? What if we knew a certain prodigal son who had done something like that to someone that we cared about? What if he had wasted our money? What if he had darkened our name, darkened our family's reputation? Now you would see more of what the story is trying to bring out here. And the natural response to those kinds of things is, well, yeah, if that were the case, then he should be punished. Let him suffer. He gets what he deserves. Let him pay for his sins. These are the natural, human, secular, carnal responses that people have toward whenever they or someone they love is injured in some way. That person needs to pay. And this is where we need to be really careful. Because what we want is justice. But what the Father wants in the account here, and remember the Father represents God, and the prodigal represents, well, sinners. What the Father wants in the account here is just to have his son back. And then the question is, who are we to question that Father? Will we judge the Father because of how he chooses to treat his son? And that really is the rub of the whole story. Sometimes we forget that all souls come from God. All souls belong to him. Not just those, you know, shiny white souls that are perfect and spotless and, you know, that smell good and go to church and have great marriages, but also those really awful souls. The souls of people who have committed lots of crimes and are just filled with hatred in their heart. God still loves those people. I tell you, I'll be honest, I struggle sometimes with how God can love them as he loves the others. But he says that he does, and he wants reconciliation with those people. And who are we to criticize that? And I think about what Jesus says in Luke 19:10, where he just lays out his whole mission statement for his ministry. The Son of Man has come to seek and save that which was lost. And the lost are those who once had a proper place, a proper status, a good, healthy relationship with God the Father. Even though they were ignorant of it or perhaps naive of it, nonetheless they had it based on their own innocence. I'm talking about little children. And Jesus seeks to find those who have strayed from that innocence, who have lost that innocence. He wants to find them and save them. And as the good shepherd, he has left heaven going out looking for those souls and is still doing so in essence through the gospel today. So the story of the prodigal son is not about who deserves what. Really, it's about grace. The story of the gospel itself is about forgiveness and reconciliation and restoration, which is what grace is all about. The Father absorbs the loss incurred by the Son in the account of the prodigal son. He suffers it by not giving his son what he knows his son actually deserved. You've got to understand, and I believe with all my heart, that when the Father saw his son coming home, he knew in his heart what that son deserved, but he was unwilling to give him what he deserved. He was willing to take that himself, in a sense, to swallow the poison that he knew was due his son. Because his love for his son was greater than his desire for compensation. And that's really where it comes down to. His love for his son was just that great. The Father was willing to suffer loss in order to have his child back, and that's what our Father did. He was willing to suffer loss, which is what we celebrate every first day of the week. That willingness for God to suffer loss just to have his children back. And we are his children. I don't mean Christians here, but just people. There are many sinners in the world, as you know, flagrant lawbreakers, maybe many prodigal sons, maybe people that we know, maybe even in our own family, maybe even some right here, for all I know. And we must be careful not to rob God because of our own self-righteous anger we might have toward those people, to rob God of what he is trying to save. After all, it's not about paying for sins. No one can afford what we have become indebted to. Sinners are saved by grace. They're not saved by payment or penance. That doesn't mean nothing's required of us, but what it does mean is that the saving process is not based upon us paying God back for what we did. There is a way to pay God back for what you did, but you won't like it. That's what hell is all about. But God doesn't want us to go there. He doesn't want to lose us. And so what God does is give gifts and not wages. And that's what the father of the prodigal son did. He gave actually two gifts to his son. First of all, he gave the inheritance, which, by the way, the son did not deserve in the sense that he didn't work for it. He didn't earn it. He was just simply the son. And so through no good deed of his own, he was given this gift. The second gift he gave was taking his son back after his son came home, the forgiveness that he provided. The son could not afford either gift. He couldn't afford the inheritance and he couldn't afford the forgiveness. And we don't want to be envious because of God's generosity, which is something you see coming out in Matthew 20 in another parable, the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, right? You remember this parable where the landowner goes out in the early morning and then later in the day and then in the afternoon and even an hour before quitting time and starts bringing people in all throughout the day and then pays them all the same. And those who were hired first are envious because they didn't get paid more because they worked harder. And the landowner is saying, why are you being envious? Because I choose to be generous. It's my money, not yours. I will do with my money what I wish. And the same is true about God. It's his forgiveness, not yours. And he will do what he wants with his forgiveness. And if he wants to forgive people, then he will forgive people. And if he wants to forgive people that you don't think should be forgiven, then he will forgive them anyway. And who are you to question him? Or who am I to question him? I'll be honest with you. I believe that when we get to heaven, if we get to heaven, then we will see people there that we don't think should have been forgiven. And then God will probably show us a mirror and say, that was you too. Will we be angry because God is a forgiving God? Don't we want God to forgive people? Isn't that what it's all about? Isn't that why we are Christians? It's because we want God to be forgiving. We want him to forgive us. We want him to forgive our loved ones. And we should even want God to forgive those heathen, irreligious, secularist, humanist people who turn away from all that stuff and turn to God and beg him for mercy. We should want him to forgive them too. I know that's hard, but it's doable. In Luke chapter 15, as the chapter starts out in Luke 15 where we find the prodigal son account, we see Jesus talking with and even eating with sinners. It says, now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near him to listen to him. Both the Pharisees and the scribes began to grumble, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. How dare he? If he should be talking to anyone, it should be us, because we're the righteous people, as they saw it. And yet he's wasting his time talking with these sinners. And then the parables come out from Jesus. And through the parables, right, Jesus teaches them that you're actually terribly mistaken. You don't understand how things are with God. Jesus does receive sinners, but he does not receive their sin. We should not mistakenly say, as we see the world doing today, that because God is receptive of sinners, therefore he accepts the behavior of sinners too. And that is not true. Never will be true. God forgives sons, but strangers he won't forgive. He can't forgive because they have chosen to be strangers and remain strangers. The question here would be, which one are you right now? Are you a son or are you a stranger? And how do you know the difference? This whole parable is not about a sinner's penance. It's about a finder's joy. Note the joy of the father when he sees his son It's like he's standing there looking afar off, and he sees his son coming down the road, and you can almost see him dropping everything. And then of all things, he starts running to his son. Now, you should know that in the Mideast, culturally, a man of dignity and stature does not run, but always walks slowly and deliberately toward anyone or anything, because running is a sign of what the little people do. What the people of lesser stature do, who don't have a dignified presence. And yet his father does not walk slowly and deliberately toward his son, ready to, you know, give him a piece of his mind, or, you know, or chastise him for all the wrongdoing. And he had every right to do so, honestly. He could have done that. But he runs to his son. Because as you see here, the protocol is less important than the son coming home. So he defies all cultural expectation. The return of the son is more important than cultural expectations. By the way, that is still true. Culture and traditions and think-sos and expectations all need to be set aside in the presence of someone who comes to God. Because them coming to God is more important than those things. The implication here, too, is that the father had been looking for his son, waiting for him, anticipating him, desiring the return of him who was lost. And he's not looking to him to berate him and condemn him, and I told you so, and he's got a whole list memorized of things he's going to say when he gets in front of his son, right? Like some of us probably have done. Let's admit it. We've been wronged by someone, and we knew that we're just sitting there seething with anger. We knew what we were going to say, that next time I see this person, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to give them a piece of my mind. Well, we should not be like that. Because what is the point of giving someone a piece of your mind? Now we're being more like the older son, who did not understand this joy of his father. From his point of view, this whole thing is very unfair, very distorted. This is a ruined picture. Very much like this woman I talked to you about in Anchorage. She just couldn't understand that. She also didn't realize that she was really taking the form of this older son. And we might be inclined to say, well, the older son deserves the ring, the robe, the calf, etc. And you're thinking about, for what? For being older? What say did he have in that? He did nothing to make that happen. For being a son? He had no choice in that either. For obeying his father? That was naturally expected. So there's no, you know, pat on the back for doing what you should have done in the first place. For payment? He'd already been compensated. The father tells him, everything I have is yours. Did the son, the older son, deserve his father's blessing for being selfish and rude and disrespectful and not rejoicing over the fact that his lost brother was found? In a sense, the older son actually condemned the younger son and the father together. The younger son for what he did to the father, and then condemned the father for not taking it out on that younger son. He condemned them both. And this is where the Jews were with regard to the Gentiles. The Gentiles are the younger son, and the Jews are the older son, and they, many of them, resented the idea that God would actually give a salvation that they should have had to something else, to someone that was beneath them. Just didn't understand. What do we do with this? How does this all work out in real life? Here's how it works out. People are going to do really mean and thoughtless and hurtful things to you. It is guaranteed. If it hasn't happened yet, give it time. It will happen. And they will take advantage of your love, and they will waste your gifts of kindness. They will drag your name through the mud if they can, and some of them will wish that you were dead, just like the younger son did with his father. Give me my inheritance. You might as well be dead to me. And after all that happens, you have a choice. You could sit there and smolder in your anger and brood over your pain and seek opportunity to retaliate. Or you can wish for divine justice to strike that person with lightning and just fry them to a crisp. Or you can pray that they will come to their senses and wait anxiously for their return. And when they do come back, if they do come back, you are there open-armed, embracing them, saying, "I'm so glad you came home." And when those people do come to their senses and return with tears and apologies, then you can demand to be compensated according to your expectation, or you can reject their apology, or you can just forgive them and go on with your life. It's not really beyond us at all to do that. It's just difficult to do that because, in essence, you have to swallow the poison that you thought was due them. And that has a very bitter taste to it, but it can be done. And by forgiving them, you're not saying you never really did anything wrong in the first place, because they did. I don't understand personally why people always say this about forgiveness. If I forgive someone, I'm pretending nothing happened. That's why you're forgiving them, because something did happen. If something hadn't happened, then you wouldn't be forgiving them. Why is this so hard to understand? And you're not saying your sins never hurt me, because they did. Sin always hurts people. We had a lesson on this several weeks ago. Sin always damages something or someone. Always, every single time. What you are saying is, my desire to imitate God and my desire for our fellowship or friendship to be restored and my love for you is more powerful and more important to me than my anger and hurt over what you did, and therefore I forgive you. That's being a man about it, so to speak. And more importantly, that's being a Christian, because that's what God did for us. His love for us is more important than destroying us, which is what we deserve. Grace is a gift. It always costs the recipient nothing and costs the giver everything. And this is why it's so hard. It seems so unjust, but grace isn't about justice. Justice is over here. Justice is about law and legality and compensation and retribution. Grace is over here about dealing with things outside of or differently than law does. Grace needs law to be fulfilled, and Christ did that for us when he died on the cross. He satisfied the need for justice. But now that that justice is satisfied, now we can give grace to others like he gives it to us. Not saving grace. You don't save anyone with your grace. God alone can do that. But it's grace all the same. And that defies worldly expectations and worldly reactions. So you have to choose to impart grace whenever possible instead of perpetuating guilt. Forgive debts, not magnify debts. Are you a kind of prodigal son yourself? I think we've all been prodigal sons. If we think about it, God wanted to forgive us all along, but we had to, if we've done this, we had to come to our senses and realize our spiritual destitution, realize how hopeless and helpless we are on our own, and then come begging to God and say, "God, I'm not worthy to be your son. Let me just be a slave." And then God says, "But you are my son, and I want you to be my son forever." That's the kind of God that we serve. And you choose as to which one you will be. A little postscript on this woman from Anchorage who struggled with the idea of God forgiving people who didn't deserve to be forgiven. She got involved with a man from Germany over the internet. She began an emotional affair with this man. She left the Lord. She left the church. She left her husband and her four children to go and be with this man. She moved to Europe to be with him and just simply dropped off the radar altogether. The question is, would you forgive her if she did this to you? What if it was your son that she left with your four grandchildren? What if she came back and begged you for forgiveness? What if her children were your grandchildren and you had to deal with all of that and compensate for the lack of this motherly presence in their lives? In the end, how do you want God to judge you for your sins? Jesus said, go and do likewise to the man who questioned him about who is my neighbor, there in the giving the Good Samaritan parable. Go and do likewise. Do what he did. Be merciful. Would you be merciful to this woman? It'd be hard to do. I'm not going to deny it. It would be really hard to do, but it is doable. Mozart, in his Requiem, has a line there. It's in Latin, but it translates to, remember, merciful Jesus, that I am the cause of your journey. We want to remember what Jesus did for us, undeserving as we are. And he calls us so that we might, in a sense, call others. And he forgives us so that we might learn to be forgiving toward others. And he wants us to be more like himself, because the more and more we are like God and like Christ, then what that means is that we will anticipate better and better what it's like to live with God in his world forever. Because that's what he wants. I want to be their God, he says, and I want them to be my people. That's the lesson for this morning. I hope there's something in there that has struck you, has helped you. Maybe there's someone here dealing with a struggle to forgive. I don't know, but statistically, it's very likely, because we all struggle with it in one way or the other. Remember what God has done for you. And like Jesus says, go and do likewise. If there's anyone that needs to respond by coming forward, this will be your opportunity as Roy leads us in song. Stand, if you would, for that song, please.